This is the Rational Reminder Podcast, a weekly reality check on sensible investing and financial decision-making for Canadians. We are hosted by me, Benjamin Felix, and Cameron Passmore. Welcome to the Rational Reminder. This is our 13th episode, and this week is just Cameron and I. We do have some great conversations with guests lined up for October and November. The podcast actually topped out at number 16 in the business category on iTunes about a week ago, which was pretty cool. We didn't really expect anything like that to happen when we started this thing.
Incredible how much it bounces around, though.
Yeah, but we've kind of been staying mostly in the top 100.
Yeah, so
in business,
how many downloads we have or what it takes to do that, but it's been nice to see it move around.
We're getting over 200 downloads per episode.
So way more than I think we ever imagined.
Yeah, definitely. So anyway, if you enjoy the podcast, please give us a rating and subscribe.
So as Ben said, it's just us this week to talk about things that we kind of picked up there during the week. Next week, we'll have a great client who's going to join us. I had lunch with Martin last Friday. And he's a retired banking executive who has a lot of experience in the credit card and debt space in Canada and has a lot of opinions as to what has been going on. So I thought that'd be interesting to have Martin on to get his views, since we get a lot of questions about debt and whatnot.
So he's going to talk about how people are using debt in Canada kind of thing?
How they're using it, what he sees as trends. That he's written a couple of white papers, so he sees some trends that he wanted to discuss with us. And he's also made some personal decisions about retiring, kind of like what Doug was talking about a couple weeks ago. So I think it'll be a really interesting discussion with a guy who's got a ton of very high level experience in financial services.
That's going to be a great conversation.
And also next week, you and I are off to Chicago for the annual DFA Advance Conference, which is an annual event. As I said, every October we head south to their annual conference. This year's in Chicago, which is home to the Booth School of Business at University of Chicago. So we're going to see Eugene Fama live and in person. So he's certainly the big draw. And we're going to bring our microphones with us, and maybe with some luck we'll get some big catch guests for the show. Who knows?
I have a feeling it's just going to be you and I nerding out about what we learned.
But these are great conferences, and it's all educational, and it's a special event to get to.
The DFA Advanced Conference, I've been here working with you for 5 years now, almost exactly 5 years actually, and I've never been able to get to the advanced conference. So this is the first time in 5 years that I've gotten a seat. It's not easy at all to get into.
Yeah, and as DFA gains in popularity, the seats are harder and harder to come by, and I know also people wonder, well, who pays for this? This is all on our dime.
Yeah, I had the question recently because we talk about DFA so much. Somebody asked me if we have a financial relationship with them. Like, obviously, a lot of wealth managers would be getting paid by a mutual fund company to use their products. And the answer to the question is that we do not have any financial relationship at all with DFA. They don't pay us a cent.
Correct.
For anything. And when we go to their conferences, like the advanced conference, like you said, we pay our own travel. We pay for our own hotel.
That's right.
They might give us a lunch. Do we get a lunch?
We get a lunch.
I guess they're paying us a bit.
So it's October 1st today. And many people, as soon as you say October, in my experience, a lot of people remember the crash of 1987. I know where I was, unless you know where you were on the day of the crash in 1987.
I was born 2 months later.
So I remember I was sitting in French class at McGill in Montreal when it was crashing. And of course, there's no smartphones, so I actually don't remember how we found out, but it was in the middle of class we found out. So I had one of my wealthy friends at McGill was so worried about his stock portfolio. I didn't really even know what he was worried about. I didn't grow up owning any stocks. But Barry Ritholtz, who we mention often on this podcast, put out a chart this morning on his daily email blast showing that actually on average, October has not been so bad. With the average monthly return for the past 20 years of almost 2.5%.
This is for U.S. stocks?
For U.S. stocks. It's actually the Dow Index.
Okay.
And then for the past 50 years, the average monthly return for October has been 0.84%. And for the last 100 years, the average monthly return has been 0.4%. So even though you may be grounded in remembering that October 87 crash, the data doesn't necessarily suggests that it's bad a month.
October is not a bad month in general.
No.
That's interesting. Our Common Sense Investing YouTube series, the video we posted last week was on permanent life insurance. And it sparked a lot of good conversation in the comments section on YouTube. So I say in the video that term life insurance is probably the most sensible insurance option for most people that have an insurance need. And in the comments, someone shared a stat for Americans. So this is not a Canada-specific stat, but presumably the data is somewhat similar. But it showed that 80% of Americans who buy whole life insurance end up canceling the policy before they die.
It's a staggering number.
I couldn't believe it either. Couldn't believe it. But it was supported by what appeared to be good data. I didn't dig too deep into it, but anyway. And that's a huge number, obviously, 80%. So 20% keep it until they die. The problem with that is that there are a ton of upfront costs when you're buying permanent life insurance, like whole life insurance. So if you end up taking your money out early, typically you're going to lose. You're going to lose money, right? Like it takes a while, maybe 10 years or more before you can actually cancel the policy and get your money back.
But how much of the long-term benefit do you think comes from the fact that so many people do cancel early? Like, is this not an argument to, if you have one or even to consider one, because so much of your total return must come from that forfeiture benefit?
Only if you're in a participating policy.
Right.
If you're in a regular whole life, you're going to get a guaranteed return. If you're in participating whole life, then we know how the experience of the insurance company affects the participating dividends. So you're right. If the insurance company sets premiums to reflect a certain cancellation rate and more people end up canceling, then the participating policyholders would get bigger dividends. But that's it's a weird asset class, participating whole life insurance, that we're not generally a fan of. Anyway, somebody else in the comment section actually took the side of defending whole life, and their explanation is an explanation that you can't argue with.
Right.
But they basically said that they've got a paid up 20-year pay, so they'll pay for their policy for 20 years, and then it's in force until they die, no matter when that is. And they argued that, sure, I might be losing out, but I'm guaranteeing this amount of liquidity for my kids. And that's, I actually say that in the YouTube video. That's exactly why you might want to buy permanent life insurance, because it will give a specific benefit at the time of death.
And I think they also referenced that. When have you met a person who might be 50 or 60 years old with a policy like this, who's actually upset they have it?
Right. That's right.
It is hard to argue with that.
Very hard. It's like having a paid-for house. Sure, you could have rented and invested the difference, but how many people complain when their house is paid off?
Exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, so I wanted to ask you, Cameron, when do you think, in your opinion, where are some cases where permanent life insurance does make sense?
Well, there's two that come to mind. One, we had a client who wanted to donate a certain amount to his church upon his passing, and he wanted to know how much it would take over the next 10 years to pay it off. So that was a perfect scenario. And we were able to get a guaranteed policy. He knows what he's paying for 10 years and is done. And another situation we did, probably one of the best ones we ever did, was someone who had multi-generational wealth inside their company. So these are retained earnings of an active business inside their company, and way more money than they would ever need. So we put in a permanent policy inside the corporation. The corporation owns the policy, so using pre-personal tax dollars to put into the policy. And when they do pass away, the money will be able to flow largely through the capital dividend accounts. There's some tax advantages to that, where the next generation will be able to extract those funds from the company and pay a much lower rate of tax. So that worked out beautifully. There's no way they'll ever need those funds. And they didn't want to give up the funds just yet to the next generation. So it was a great strategy in that case. And they would have to live the internal rate of return, even excluding, I'm doing this from memory, but even excluding any tax benefits, the internal rate of return into their 90s was 2 to 3% per year.
Right.
Internal rate of return. And when we gave that data to them, they said, well, there's no way we're going to live that long. They said, well, the insurance company looks at many people like you, and this is what their assessment is. So let's hope you do. And they said, if we do live that long, we'll be thrilled. Right? It's not about the math, of course,
right,
at that point. So
that's interesting. 2 to 3%. So that's kind of what we've talked about in the past, is that when you're looking at that specific play where you're using money that you're never going to need, and the argument for the holding company and for a high net worth individual are somewhat similar, because in both cases there are tax advantages. Obviously, investment income in a corporation is taxed at close to the highest marginal personal rate. And then if you're at the highest marginal personal tax bracket, any personal investments are taxed at the highest marginal rate. When you dump money into an insurance policy, it grows without being taxed.
Right.
Which is pretty attractive when you have a high income. But like the 2 to 3%, even with the tax benefits, I don't think that you could argue that a permanent insurance policy will outpace a 100% equity portfolio. But insurance can maybe be part of your fixed income allocation if it's money that you're never going to need.
That's exactly the rules that I've been using.
Yeah.
And then the accountant suggested that the tax savings on the other side are roughly 30 to 35%. So that internal rate of return I quoted is before we even consider that.
Right. Yeah. It's an interesting play in very specific cases. Yeah. But in general, like most people listening, you probably don't have a need for permanent insurance.
Yeah. You want to talk about housing?
Yeah. There was a lot of headlines about that last week.
A lot of headlines, and I had a lot of conversations with people. So it's clear that housing is on the minds of a lot of people. So RBC had a report out last week saying that their housing affordability measure has not been as bad as it is now since 1990. The ownership cost to carry a home right now would have taken up 53, 54% of a typical household's income.
Crazy.
It's a staggering number. That's the Canadian average, correct?
That's right. In Vancouver, it would take 88.4% of income. Ottawa's looking pretty good, 38.6%.
And Toronto, where I was last week, is 75.9%.
Does this mean it's a good time to buy in Ottawa?
Well, this is a question you get, right? What should someone do? All I know is the discussion that people there said if they came to Ottawa with the kind of budget they need to have in Toronto, they'd be able to buy just a phenomenal
right.
property.
Yeah, it's very interesting how all of the economics work on that stuff. So that data you were just citing was from an RBC report. UBS also had a report out last week talking about housing bubbles around the world. And in the top five, there were two Canadian cities, Toronto and Vancouver, in terms of being at risk for a housing bubble. In front of them were Hong Kong and Munich. And in their report, UBS did a really balanced job of describing a bubble, which, of course, if you believe in an efficient market, you don't believe that a bubble can exist. But they kind of work that into their definition. So they say...
Or at least it's only visible in hindsight.
Well, that's why I say this UBS report was so balanced. So they say price bubbles are a regularly recurring phenomenon in property markets. The term bubble refers to a substantial and sustained mispricing of an asset, the existence of which cannot be proved unless it bursts. So there's that statement right there.
Yeah.
But historical data reveals patterns of property market excesses. Typical signs include a decoupling of prices from local incomes and rents. So that's kind of what we were talking about with the affordability from that RBC report. And imbalances in the real economy, such as excessive lending and construction activity. The UBS Global Real Estate Bubble Index gauges the risk of a property bubble on the basis of such patterns. So basically they're saying that in Toronto and Vancouver, there's been this decoupling of economic activity within the city, so incomes and actual house prices. That's where that affordability issue becomes pretty serious. Rob Carrick had a post last week talking about the increasing use of HELOCs, home equity lines of credit, in Canada. And he shows that the most expensive housing markets have the highest HELOC balances. And he kind of suggests that people might be using HELOCs as a crutch to get by in those more expensive markets.
And this is the exact kind of question we should cover off next week with Martin.
Yeah.
This is right in its wheelhouse.
Yeah, that'll be great to talk about with him. For now, I'm pretty happy to be a renter.
So when I was in Toronto last week, a person I was speaking with is looking to buy a property. And in 1 week, he was outbid on three different properties by a significant amount. And he went over ask, which certainly suggests a bubble. But you have so many people flowing into Toronto right now. And many people want to avoid the daily commute to the suburbs. So I think that's the argument for wanting to live downtown and was driving prices up. But he sent me a really neat affordability study looking at 28 Ontario cities. And then after putting a 20% down payment, looked at how much salary you need to carry that mortgage compared to what the median income is in that area. So number one, city for the widest gap between what you need to have and what your median income is, Richmond Hill had the widest gap. You know, almost a $50,000 spread of annual income. Toronto came in second. Most of the cities that were at the high end of the unaffordability index were in the Toronto area.
And the gaps are huge between what you would need to afford to buy and the actual average income. I don't really know what that says about, well, I guess that's kind of what the UBS report was talking about in terms of bubbles. That's a decoupling of prices with actual incomes.
But look at the difference. Like Toronto, $785,000 average price for sales in July or August. It's current data. Ottawa came in 26 out of 28 with $433,000 average price. That was the average sale amount.
Good time to be in Ottawa, I guess.
And the income needed is $26,000 less than the average income. So it's a complete inverse here than what people are living in Toronto.
Yeah.
But I tell you, Toronto's booming. It's unbelievable. Many people may have seen the Shopify announcement last week where they're putting in, you know, $500 million commitment to new office space. Other companies, and this is what I heard from many people last week, you know, companies like Google, Microsoft, Uber, Intel, Pinterest, NVIDIA, LG, Samsung are all recently announced new offices in Toronto. So you got to think that's more people, more income. They like the urban lifestyle. They don't want to commute. To me, that suggests rising home prices right there.
And would you say that, so we know that based on current data, incomes are not high enough to justify prices, but with growth like that, do you think that the market is just pricing in the potential for rising incomes?
I would guess so. We're not talking missing, you know, your offers by a little bit. We're talking about significant misses, like in the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
We've seen that in Ottawa, too.
Data in Ottawa. I mean, nothing like that in Ottawa.
We've seen that in Ottawa. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Same margins, same magnitude of outbiddings. I've heard two or three stories like that recently. Fama would say, I think, I'm putting words in Eugene Fama's mouth, but I imagine he would say that the market is just pricing in future income growth.
That seems sensible to me.
Because Fama would never say there's a bubble, obviously.
So one of our favorite podcasters, Ben Carlson, I thought had a really neat post last week on, he called it undervalued financial advice. He's basically making the point that so much financial advice that is out there these days, you know, it's kind of, to me, throwaway advice, like avoid buying fancy coffees and things like that, kind of on the spending side, which, not that I'm suggesting you waste money, but you got to keep your eye on the big picture. The four main points he made: one is avoid the allure of more. And we see that as people's income increases, you often get inflation creepage in their spending, kind of keeps up with their income. And we're coaching more and more people now to figure out what sort of lifestyle you're happy in, and try to stay there where you can. So at least you lag your increase in income and try to save more.
We've had a lot of people say when they've had a major liquidity event, they've specifically said to us, you know, basically keep us in check. Make sure we don't start getting out of hand with spending, because it's easy to do when the cash is there.
It's easy, but boy, a lot of the young people we work with have not had the creep go on, remarkably. And once you get so close to freedom, even at a young age, you say, well, I've got freedom now. To me, the freedom is worth more than the increased lifestyle.
Than the stuff.
The stuff.
You don't need stuff.
Don't need more stuff. Number two, envy is more expensive than gratitude. So no generation has ever had a higher standard of living than this one. So kind of messages, be happy with what you have.
Well, we've got a couple, very affluent clients who actually systematically dumpster dive. There are stores that you can go to when they close. And I guess the stores, it seems like it's the whole game. So a group of people will meet up at a store.
Really?
The store will dump stuff in the garbage, but they'll put it in like nice cardboard boxes so it's easy to
cause retrieve?
Yeah.
You serious?
Oh, yeah. Because the store can't give it away or whatever, because there's regulations around that, I guess. And they don't want people to get sick, and there's liability and all that stuff. So they, air quotes, throw the food away. But somehow they've communicated, or people know to go to the store and pick up this food from the dumpster.
Time and health matter more than wealth. I think I saw a comparison between, let's say you're 20 years old with no money, and Warren Buffett with all his money. I guarantee you he would trade his 60 years to become 20 years old and broke again for what he has now. And the last one, the last tip is stay married. Interesting, the stats on this, the median married household had 10 times the savings that a typical single household.
Single or is that divorced? Or did it say?
Just said single. Okay. It said single. And Ohio University research found that the wealth of an average divorced person falls 77%.
Jeez.
Yeah, because of the few years leading up to the divorce and the subsequent years often cause financial strain.
Wow.
So main message there is to find a financially compatible spouse.
Crazy. I just finished listening to Fortune's Children, which is a book written by a Vanderbilt about the Vanderbilt family. And they were, for a long time, the richest family in the world. Cornelius Vanderbilt built a steamship empire when steamships were a thing. And then in his 80s, I believe, or was it in his 60s? When he was getting a bit older, he started a railroad empire and then ended up controlling the New York Central, which is one of the largest, most profitable railways in the world. So they're mega wealthy. But the book talks about three or four generations of the family and how they ended up with no money left at the end. But that to what the point you were just making, one of the biggest reasons that the money disappeared was that a couple of the grandsons of Cornelius Vanderbilt ended up marrying women who weren't bad people and they weren't maliciously spending, but they wanted a certain level of lifestyle and a certain level of stuff and houses, and it just bled these last two grandsons dry. Then they ended up with very small estates.
Isn't Anderson Cooper's mother a Vanderbilt?
I don't know.
I believe
there
so.
There are many, many descendants.
I know he said his mother is wealthy, I believe, subject to correction, but I believe he said that he assumes he's getting nothing as an inheritance. Now, I'm sure he's fine, obviously.
Right.
But I believe his mother's a Vanderbilt.
But in the book, there's one of the other points that you mentioned, avoiding the allure of more. There was a quote in that book, in Fortune's Children, that really stuck out at me, to me on that. And it's from William H. Vanderbilt, who is the oldest son of Cornelius Vanderbilt. So he inherited all of his father, the majority of his father's wealth. I think it was like $100 million that he inherited. And he actually doubled that, but before he died. But anyway, so William H. Vanderbilt was the richest man in the world by far. And he made this comment to a friend about his neighbor. He said, "He isn't worth 1/100th part as much as I am, but he has more of the real pleasures of life than I have. His house is as comfortable as mine, even if it didn't cost as much. His team of horses, I believe, is about as good as mine. His opera box is next to mine. His health is better than mine, and he'll probably outlive me. And he can trust his friends." But it's kind of a theme throughout the book that while these Vanderbilts are so wealthy, they're not happier than anybody else. So that's the Vanderbilt story actually encompasses a lot of the things that you just said, because it does talk about avoiding that allure of more, and then it also talks about marrying a financially compatible spouse. So that's obviously an extreme story with many more zeros than most people deal with, but the themes remain true.
I'm just thinking of this now. I was talking to a client last week, and the classic big spend in retirement is, I want to travel more. And then the realization, you know what? We don't.
Huh.
We don't really want to travel more. Yeah, a trip or two a year, but nothing too crazy. And they said, we don't enjoy the crowds. We don't enjoy battling airports. We don't want to do the battling trains across Europe. And I'm not suggesting that's not fun. This was their opinion. They're just going to be happier in a lower cost retirement. So you actually, I think many people kind of paint this picture of what they think they should have in retirement. But when you actually think about what you want to do, it may not be as expensive as you think.
That's very interesting. I don't know what I would want to do. What would you want to do?
Well, this sounds weird, but I love what I do. I just want to live closer to work so I can walk to work like you. I don't really want to stop doing this. I mean, a little bit of travel, but I'm not crazy about travel. But you have to have something to accomplish. You have to have some mission to be on. I couldn't imagine just a classic retirement.
Yeah, I couldn't either.
Maybe one day, but certainly not yet. It wouldn't be a podcast if we don't talk about active versus passive fund managers, of course. So you dug up a study that came out, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, talking about U.S. active fund managers and how this really wasn't a stock picker's year after all. So you would think that based on Trump and political uncertainty and PE ratios and whatnot, that this would be a year to shine for the stock pickers, which we always hear is going to be the year of. And I don't think it was so much this year. Over the trailing 12 months, only 36% of active funds in the U.S. beat their benchmark index. Should it have been more? I'm not so certain. You have, a handful of stocks that are responsible for a huge amount of returns, like Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, responsible for a quarter of the gains in the S&P 500 for the past 12 months.
Ending June, yeah, that's right.
So all you do is get those right or overweight those, you would have done it. But so maybe the 36% makes sense. What do you think?
Well, there was a paper that came out in 2015 that mathematically showed with a sort of simulated market why the distribution of returns, of stock returns, is probably much more responsible for active funds underperforming than fees. Like fees often take the credit for active funds underperforming on average. But this study showed that because we know empirically a relatively small number of stocks in the market are responsible for most of the returns.
And that's all the time.
In a given year, right. This year's maybe been a bit more extreme, but in any given year, that is true. So this paper shows that that distribution, just based on active managers picking portfolios that are subsets of the overall market and knowing that the overall market has a relatively large proportion of its returns concentrated in a relatively small number of stocks, that makes it really, really hard for the average active manager to outperform, even before fees. That is what it is. That makes it very hard for active managers. And when you have indexes, which are cap-weighted, as those huge companies get bigger and bigger, as their valuations increase, the indexes end up holding a higher weight in them, which, again, it is what it is. If you get lucky and there's a run-up and you end up owning more of a stock that's doing well and it continues to do well, then your returns will be good. Now, this has interesting implications for us in the way that we manage our clients' portfolios, where we're obviously not active managers. Like, we're not picking stocks by any means, but our portfolios are different from the market, and that does show up in returns. So we obviously expect the return difference between a value and small tilted portfolio to be positive over the long term. But when you have those large cap growth stocks in the U.S. that are really driving returns, not just in the U.S., but they're really driving returns this year all over the world. Like, international and Canadian stocks have not done much.
Nowhere near what the U.S. has done.
And U.S. has done, they've had great returns, especially in Canadian dollars this year. But a lot of that's been driven by that small handful of companies. So I looked at the weights of those three companies that have been responsible for 25% of the S&P 500 return in XUU, which is the iShares U.S. total market, so a cap-weighted ETF of U.S. stocks, and 9.3% of its assets are in Apple, Amazon, and Microsoft.
Amazing.
Yeah, so almost 10% of the total U.S. market is these three stocks. And the DFA Global portfolios, it's more like 4.4% allocated to those three stocks.
Right, because we'll always have exposure to those stocks. We just underweight them because they're large cap growth.
Correct. So you've got about half the exposure relative to a cap weighted index, which over the long term we expect to be obviously a good thing. But over this specific time period, the DFA U.S. equity allocation year to date, as at the end of September, had been 9.23% in Canadian dollars, while the Russell 3000, so total U.S. market, is up 14.62% in Canadian dollars. So obviously you see that spread. So what happens in portfolios when that's happening? Kind of, I guess, the opposite of what would have been good over this time period, because of what would have been great is just loading up on those stocks that have been doing really well because they continue to do well. But the reality is that in portfolios, they're being rebalanced back into those value stocks that have been underperforming.
So you're selling the large cap growth stocks
that are doing well,
yeah. And you're going and buying other, at the other extreme, small cap value, so the beaten up small companies.
Exactly. So rebalancing into the pain.
That happens all the time.
Yeah.
Around the world inside the portfolios.
And that's what any index portfolio should be doing, the same thing. Like, any index investor this year will probably be, like a couch potato investor, for example. Well, couch potato is three ETFs now. A regular ETF investor with multiple ETFs for different allocations would be selling off some U.S. stocks to buy international and Canadian, which have been either flat or negative.
And emerging markets, for sure.
Yeah.
Speaking of Amazon, did you see the new Amazon four-star store in Soho?
It's crazy. Such a cool idea.
Cool idea. Live pricing, I understand it, based on demand.
Such a cool idea.
And reviews. The reviews show up live on these little screens. Very cool.
Well, we got to tell people what it is. It's a store that is only selling products with a four-star or higher rating on Amazon.
Yeah, a physical store for Amazon.
It's very cool.
Very cool. Had a good weekend of reading. I think I mentioned to you my leaf blower, my grass trimmer, and my lawnmower all died at the same time. So I said, fine, I guess I'm not destined to do yard work. So I went inside and read for most of the afternoon yesterday, which was great. So one of the books I actually finished off, I don't know if you read it or not, but your sister Tessa recommended it, is called The Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz. Have you read it?
No. Tessa told me about it, but I've never read it.
I'm sure many listeners have heard of it or even read it, but it's a really great read, simple read. Comes out with the four agreements you have to have with yourself. Be impeccable with your word, things like avoid gossip and empty promises, say what you mean, and realize that by saying things that may not be nice can cause problems. Number two, don't take anything personally. People's behavior is a reflection on them, not on you, and opinions are very subjective, and everybody has biases, so don't take it personally. Number three, don't make assumptions. So the point they're making is that there can be much stress caused by making assumptions about something or someone without actually checking with the other person. And lastly, always do your best, and then you have no regrets in life. I realize these are simple, straightforward points, but the book is really well done. It's a quick read, so highly recommend it.
A lot of life lessons today from the Ben Carlson post and that book.
Well, that's what we're all about, right? Life lessons. what have you been reading lately?
Well, I just finished listening to that Vanderbilt book. I mentioned last week the Charles Duhigg book. I believe it's called Smarter, Better, Faster, Smarter, something like that, about productivity. So I'll pick that one back up now that I've done the Vanderbilt book. The Vanderbilt book was cool. I mean, some of the stuff they talk about is like just the celebrity status of the richest people and how they had, they'd have their own newsletters. And you think it's exactly the same as having a Facebook feed or an Instagram feed or whatever. People would write, like famous rich people would write newsletters about what's going on in their lives. It's like, man, the world hasn't really changed that much. Wow. We just have better technology.
Yeah, my next one I'm on now is Mindset, which was mentioned in the Shane Parrish podcast a couple of weeks ago with Toby. So that'll be, it's a very, very good read. So I'm about a third of the way through.
Oh, that would be good. I might have to pick that up after you. Anything else?
That's it. Talk to you next week from Chicago.
All right. Talk to you later.